Going to the cloud, mute everyone. Okay, so our topic for tonight is a specific incident in American Jewish history, not a broad theme necessarily, although we'll touch on how it fits into the broader picture, but this is a specific incident in Charleston, South Carolina, in which a synagogue underwent internal division that led to, sadly, a break in the shul and creation of a separatist congregation over issues of reform versus tradition in the way they conduct the services. So the congregation is Kahal Kadosh Beit Elohim in Charleston, South Carolina. There had been Jews in South Carolina since 1695. The congregation had been around since 1749. They had had a building in which they were davening since 1794. And it was Minhag Sfarad, the old Spanish-Portuguese rite. The people who were the members of this congregation were, for the most part, Spanish-Portuguese, although there were plenty of German Jews as well, as was the case in all the Kihilot, where German Jews eventually outnumbered the Spanish-Portuguese, despite the fact that the was conducted in the old Sephardic. Well, by 1824, Charleston was by far the largest and strongest of all the Jewish communities in America. They had 700 Jews. New York only had 550. And Jews constituted 5% of the white population in Charleston. So in 1824, 47 members of this congregation petitioned the board, the Ma'amad, the Junta, the leadership, for certain changes to make the service more to their liking, more palatable. These Jews in Charleston were prominent participants in the commercial, philanthropic, and social life of the city. So we're not talking about parochial Jews on the margins of society. We're talking about prominent Americans, active in civic life, who happen to be Jewish and go to services and want those services to be more in the style of the times. Okay. So who were the intellectual influences upon this earliest attempt at the reform of Judaism in the United States? Well, to an extent, they were influenced by the city of Charleston's long-standing tradition of religious liberalism and pluralism. But at least as far as the Protestant denominations were concerned, there had been a long tradition of a relaxed attitude on ritual and doctrine. And we try to make people happy in the religious sphere. Okay, that's one factor, their natural environment in the United States. Another consideration is they were aware of the beginnings of reform that were happening in Europe. So for those of you who paid attention last year or the year before, we discussed the history of non-Orthodox Judaism in the last two centuries. We spent a lot of time on the origins of reform in Germany, the Seisen Temple of Israel Jacobson in 1810, and the Hamburg Temple controversy of 1818, in particular with regard to their prayer book, the Siddur, and how that led to an Orthodox backlash. And essentially, the origins of Orthodoxy are in response to the Hamburg Temple crisis. Well, they know about this because it's 1824, and that happened a decade earlier, or half a decade earlier. We shouldn't claim that Reform Judaism migrated with the Hamonam, with the masses of German Jews, from Europe to America. That really didn't happen. Really, Reform in America, as we shall see, is a local phenomenon where Jews who had been traditionalists upon their arrival transformed themselves religiously to fit the environment in America. And if there was any ideological influence, it was by the rabbis who came later. But the rabbis are nowhere to be found here in 1824. There isn't one rabbi in America. They won't come till the 1840s and more in the 1850s. So, but there's an awareness of the stirrings of reform in Central Europe. Okay. It's also possible that the reform-minded Jews of Charleston were influenced by Karaism, the Karaites. Now, that might sound like a very odd thing. You know, Karaism was invented in the 8th century in Babylonia. What does that have to do with Jews in Charleston, South Carolina, 1,000 years later? Well, the answer is that Karaism was quite popular among the Muranos, among those Jews whose ancestors had been the victims of the Spanish Inquisition and who departed from overt Judaism for some stretch of time. And then even when they returned to Judaism, that return was basically to a religion that favored the Bible, but the Bible only, and not rabbinical teachings of the Talmud. So in Western Europe and the British Isles and elsewhere, from the 16th century and onward, you do have this Karaitic element or pseudo-Karaitic element that is hostile to rabbinic Judaism, even while within the camp of Judaism. And we shall see in Charleston, those sorts of ideas will take off. Okay. The Jews of Charleston were also influenced by Unitarianism. What is Unitarianism? Well, the joke is it's one step down from Reformed Judaism. But it's no joke, actually. In this instance, it's true. The Unitarian minister in Charleston was a man by the name of Samuel Gilman. He sounds like a Jewish congressman from Brooklyn, Samuel Gilman. But he was actually a Gentile and a Protestant minister, a Unitarian minister, and he went to visit Beit Elohim for services, and he was disappointed in what he saw, because what he saw was Jews coming in and out as they pleased without any decorum and any deference for the conduct of the service, and chattering away even during the holy parts of the davening. A comment from Moshe: are Maranos really embracing charism, or just rejecting rabbinic Judaism because of a lack of exposure for hundreds of years? So that's a very good question. And the answer is probably it's the latter. It's probably lack of exposure to rabbinic Judaism, and so therefore they don't know about it, and they're less likely to accept it. However, it should be noted that there were times that they felt that certain rabbinic usages were repulsive and were bigoted. So we're going to see tonight, it's not just that they don't know about the Talmud or the Mishnah or the Poskim, it's that sometimes they find certain aspects of post-biblical Judaism to be abhorrent. So you take that for what it's worth. It's not a direct line of connection necessarily to the Karaites of the Middle East, but it's a similar idea. Okay. Asher has a comment. Remarkable it is that we tend to think of Jewish immigration to be linear from the British Isles or the continent to Newark or Boston. What's amazing is the presence of the sizable Jews that came from the Caribbean. That's true. A significant number of Jews who lived in the United States in the earlier decades of the Republic did come from Caribbean islands. Although eventually that migration fizzles out because it's tapped out. There are no more Jews left in the Isles. Okay, so the service at Beit Elohim was problematic. How was it problematic, at least from the perspective of those who were worshiping there? It was too long. On Shabbos, how long does davening take in the various shuls of Westchester or Long Island? You know, Young Israel here, Young Israel there. What does it take, 2 hours, 2 hours and 10 minutes for the sermon? So this service was taking 3 hours without a sermon, and they were rushing. It was claimed that if they didn't rush, it would take 4 hours. Why? Well, because at least in the Spanish-Portuguese rite, everything is said out loud. In the Psuka de Zimra is word for word by the precentor out loud. It takes time. Okay, the Sephardic service will always take longer than the Ashkenazic service, even when their Ashkenazic service is not rushing. Okay, so that's one consideration. The other is that the service was unintelligible. It was conducted in Hebrew with the announcements made in Spanish or Portuguese as a reminder of the good old days, of the old Sephardic rite from the old world. So nobody spoke Spanish, nobody spoke Portuguese, they don't understand the announcements, and there's no sermon in English, it's just Hebrew davening, they don't really know Hebrew. So what's in it for the average person who was an Americanized Jew living at that time? Hardly anything. It reminds me of in some shuls, you know how they did Mevarchim Chodesh, they announced the Molad. So in some shuls, they announced the Molad in Yiddish, despite the fact that nobody in the shul understands a word of Yiddish. Okay, it happens. So that's the same thing here. The announcements were made in a language that was outdated. Okay. So some members of the synagogue came to recognize the dichotomy between their religious worship, which lacked any real interest on the part of the worshiper, and had no decorum, versus other aspects of their lives, which had dignity and clarity and intellectual and emotional stimulation. There's no emotional and intellectual stimulation in a davening you don't understand. There's no kavana, garnish, there's nothing. So they wanted to reform the religion in order to save the religion. Quote, certain defects which are apparent in the present worship system have to be eliminated, then we seek no other end than the future welfare of our nation, of Judaism. Notice they use the word nation in reference to Judaism. We cannot withhold from the rising generation the more rational means of worshiping the true God. So we want rational worship, not chaotic, crazy worship from the old world. And the focus is on the rising generation, the young people who were born in the United States, who were not born in the old world, and really have no emotional attachment to a service that is unintelligible to them. And lastly, we wish not to overthrow, but to rebuild. We wish not to destroy, but to reform and revise the evils complained of. We wish not to abandon the institutions of Moses, but to understand them and observe them. So notice Moses, the Mosaic Code, the Pentateuch, the five books, the Chamisha Chumshei Torah, that's all well and good. We love the Chumash, good. What do we not love necessarily? The post-biblical usages of Judaism, okay? And we want to understand the Mosaic Code, and we don't for lack of knowledge of Hebrew, so we're going to need English language edifying sermons to teach us some Yiddish Jewish content. Okay, well, what proposed changes do they have in mind? Four in particular. One, English translation of the prayers. Not that the whole service had to be devoid of Hebrew, but that a good chunk of it should be translated into English. By the way, this is something that in many American synagogues, including Orthodox ones, was commonly done until not that long ago, until it became popular for Jewish kids to go to day school. All right, so you had in 19th and 20th century synagogues this idea of a translation of prayers, and on the high holidays, maybe even more so, because you have less educated Jews in the pews. Secondly, abridge the services through some omissions. Well, let me ask you a question. What are we going to omit? There's a lot there. What's going to be excised? Anybody know?
Rabbinically added prayers.
The rabbi's speech.
The rabbi's, no, they want a speech. And as for rabbinically added prayers, all the whole sinner is rabbinically added. I mean, there's
the preliminary prayers. What we
okay, good. So preliminary, meaning the material that is in front of Pesukei de Zimra, like Korbanot, or various other non-statutory items in the prayer book. And as Asher notices, right now, because of COVID, many shuls are going to eliminate the piyutim, okay? We're going to cut the high holiday services to the bone by taking out all the favorite pieces that everybody sings and only have, the statutory prayers. Well, that's what's being requested here in 1824. We know what's important. We know what's less important. It takes too long to do everything, so cut out the less important stuff. Okay. Abolish money offerings during the service. This is a very important piece of the puzzle. Raise money by selling kibudim, by selling honorific rolls of the service. Ad hayom hazeh, until our very day, it's still done in many shuls. Now, some places it's only done in like Simchas Torah, they sell the Atah HaResa, or they sell the Aliyahs, like Chasim Torah. Some places they do it Yom Kippur, they sell Psicha for Ne'ilah, you know, for a lot of money. Okay, but it's relatively limited. In the Sephardic congregation of early American history, Shot and various kibudim were sold every Shabbos, and it took time. You know, the Ershtamol, the Tzvetamol, the Dritamol, Zacha. Okay, or however you say that in Portuguese, I don't know how. But that takes time. It's also very undignified. Some people think it's crass and tasteless to have money being thrown around, like not actual dollars, but the pledge of dollars in competition during the service. I personally always felt that was the case. When I was growing up in the Great Neck Synagogue, we never did this other than for Simchas Torah, and it always struck me the wrong way, and then they abolished it. Okay? But some shuls do it all the time, and it just doesn't sit well with people. What I wanted was the English language sermon. They wanted a Parshat HaShavua discourse in English. So the people would learn something, because remember, the Kriyas HaTorah, the reading of the Torah, is supposed to be an educational experience. If you read the Gemara, the Talmudic literature, it's clear that the reading of the Torah, together with its Targum, was supposed to teach people the content of Judaism. Well, the Targum was done away with a long time ago. So now we're just left with the Hebrew Torah reading that the Baal Koreh does with the Trup. And who's paying attention to it? Who actually knows what the meaning of the words? Very few people. So what do you need? You need an edifying sermon. Good, that's what they want. Fine. Well, do they get what they want? That's the question. So they propose these changes to the board, and the board outright rejects their demands because they feel that these changes which pertain to the liturgical aspect of synagogue life, constitutional matter. This is not a petty little change, who gets to sponsor the Kiddush, but rather it goes to the heart of what we are as a synagogue. And a constitutional change, according to the Constitution of 1820, ratified by the board, by the membership of the synagogue, required a two-thirds majority vote for any change. So the traditionalists argued that liturgical change was a constitutional matter. The reformers argued, no, it wasn't. It's just a minor matter that we want, and hopefully by majority vote of the board, we can get done. Okay. So the reformers met on November 21st, 1824, to formulate their petition. They were rejected, and then after they realized that they lacked a two-thirds majority to pass this in a congregational meeting, they then, on January 16th, 1825, to the Reformed Society of Israelites. Reformed Society of Israelites. And let me ask you again, why Israelites and not Jews? Because dirty word. You want to be known as Israelites. It's more biblical. It sounds more pleasing. Jew has a negative connotation. Okay. So they unanimously approve their own constitution by a vote of 44 to nothing on February 15th, 1825. What do they do for their synagogue and this Reformed Society? Well, they abbreviate the service considerably. They compose new prayers for the synagogue, and they write entirely new liturgical pieces for life cycle occasions. This is important, by the way, this business with the life cycle occasions. There is liturgy for a wedding, you know, the Sheva Brachas, the Brachas of the Kiddushin. There's liturgy for a bris, you know, you welcome Eliyahu HaNavi and you make the Bracha Lakos. There's liturgy for a Pinnah Ben. There's liturgy for every life cycle event. But sometimes it's not so compelling. It's a little outdated. So what did they do? They created new liturgy for these life cycle events because it was going to be a big deal. This is the beginnings of American Judaism as life cycle Judaism. Something we're very familiar with today. People who want to go to shul, but they have to have a rabbi at the unveiling, a rabbi at the funeral, a rabbi at the wedding. Life cycle Judaism. This is the beginning, a little bit over here. Okay. So, what else do they do? They daven without hats, without head coverings. Whoa, that's a big one. No yarmulke. And they add instrumental music, an organ. And they develop a new creed. What is this new creed that they're developing? I mean, that sounds pretty peculiar. Well, the focus is on rationalism, that all religious faiths have to be brought under the test of human philosophy. So in other words, it's not the received tradition that is being accepted no matter what as binding just because it's the received tradition, but rather everything will be scrutinized under the through the prism of human philosophy, whatever that means. So the traditionalists denounced the Reformed Society for their revised version of the Maimonidean Creed, that the Reformed Society put out a 10-point platform, similar to the Rambam's 13 points, but except there's 10 and not 13. So clearly three of them got cut. They didn't make the roster. So what are those things that were cut? One, divine revelation of Torah. Two, the expectation of the coming of the Messiah. Three, resurrection of the dead. So this will be an important element in Reform Judaism going forward in the United States, that the various platforms that will be issued in the 19th century will reject resurrection, will reject the messianic arrival. And as for revelation of Torah, so there will be mixed attitudes within the Reform camp on the notion of revelation, but it certainly will not be the traditionalist notion of accepting, you know, the beginning of Pirkei Avos in literal form. Okay. So they added certain parts to their creed. One was that morality is the basic foundation of all religion. That's nice. Is it true? Well, you could argue it's not on two grounds. One, that sometimes the foundation of religion has nothing to do with morality. It has to do just with accepting dogmas of the past. And secondly, sometimes you have bad religions whose foundation is far from moral in my eyes or anybody else's eyes, you know, like Al-Qaeda. So that's one thing they added. They also added the immortality of the soul. Why do they add that? So again, this will be another important one in the puzzle of Reform Judaism, that you can't just reject the hereafter altogether. Because if you do that, then you're going to lose people who will want to know, well, why am I being virtuous in this world? You can reject heaven and hell. You can reject bodily resurrection. But then you're going to have to replace it with something. And that something is the immortality of the soul. Because if you don't even have that, then you might as well be an atheist. Okay. So David is asking, who led the vanguard of this movement? Doesn't sound like a complete Amaretz. Okay. So the answer to that is Isaac Harbi, someone who we've encountered a couple of times already in our discussions, was the leader of the group. And he was not especially learned, but, you know, knew something. And they would eventually hire a chazan who would become their ideological leader. And we'll talk about him in about 15 minutes. We'll get to the chazan who they hire, thinking he was traditional, but who turns out to be radical reform. Okay. So in 1826, the Reformed Society, Len says, there's no mention of participation of women. So you're right. This is a man's domain for the time being. That will change in the 1850s, 60s, and 70s with the arrival of the Reform rabbis in mid-century and the transformation of many synagogues, in fact, almost all American synagogues into Reform synagogues, when then they will have mixed pews and women's participation in not so much the conduct of the service, but in the life of the synagogue. Okay, so in 1826, the Reform Society had 50 members. Beit Elohim had 70 subscribers. Isaac Harbi claimed that the Reform Society would have had many more members and that an overwhelming majority of the young people favored their cause, but that many young people did not jump ship and abandon Beit Elohim out of respect for their elders, meaning mommy and daddy are longtime members of Beit Elohim. I want a Reform service, but mommy and daddy are important to me. Maybe I want to inherit the Yerusha, who knows what, and I can't offend their religious sensibilities, so I'll stay with the old line shul, even though I don't especially like it. That's what Harbi is claiming happened, and he's probably right. And we know that even from our own days, where you have people who wouldn't be members of the Orthodox shul, but grandma or grandpa wants it, so they show up when they're told to. Okay. In 1826, the Reform Society solicited subscriptions for the building of a synagogue building. They want to build their own building. They don't want to have rented quarters. Build their own shul. And a Talmud Torah. Why? Because it's important for them to teach their brand of Judaism to the so-called rising generation, the young people born in America who otherwise don't know much about Yiddishkeit and have to be taught something. Well, we'll teach them our version of it. So, quote, and in their attempt to solicit subscriptions, they make the following points about their program. One, to introduce such a change in the mode of worship that a considerable portion of the prayers be said in English, so that by being understood, they would be attended by that religious instruction in our particular faith, essential to the rising generation, and so generally neglected. Meaning, the old shul has been neglecting the real religious and spiritual needs of our people. We will not neglect that. We will give the people what they need. Secondly, to discontinue the observance of such ceremonies as partake strongly in bigotry, as we owe their origin only to rabbinical institutions, and as are not embraced in the moral laws of Moses, and in many instances are contrary to their spirit and to their beauty and sublimity. So give me an example of a rabbinical institution in Judaism that someone who's sort of disaffected by rabbinic Judaism and has a so-called love for biblical Judaism might say is a bad thing. Give me an example of a bad thing in rabbinic Judaism in the eyes of a reformer.
Second day of Yom Tov on certain holidays.
Second day of Yom Tov. Good. Bingo. We're going to get to that. They try to abolish it 15 years later. What else?
Intermarriage.
That is not yet something that is on the agenda. Not just yet. It will be eventually. In early 1900s, the CCR will have to address that. But not yet. Any other ideas?
What about Sabbath observance?
Sabbath observance is in the Bible. Frankfurt. You can't argue with Shabbos.
Eating kosher.
Kosher is in the Bible for the most part. I mean, uh-huh. It is.
The business with divorced women and
Aguna.
The get.
Okay, all right, so that's, you're right. The issue of the get plays a role, not necessarily here, but by the 1860s plays an important role. So I was thinking of Purim. Purim is a horrible thing in the eyes of people who are not patriotic Jews. Why? Because we killed the anti-Semites. It's a chauvinistic holiday, Purim. And so what did the Reform Society of Israelites do? They abolished Purim. How do you like that? They abolished Purim.
Wow. Okay.
It's too Jewish, not Israelitish enough. Okay.
It's too Jewish.
All right.
What about Hanukkah, though?
So Hanukkah, interestingly, they kept Hanukkah. They have a small liturgy for Hanukkah. But Hanukkah played almost no role in the life of Reform Judaism until the 1920s, when it was brought back as an alternative. Okay, so let's keep going. One second. Okay. The society didn't do very well. Isaac Harvey left for New York in 1828, and the society shut down completely by 1833. They never built a building, and so they had money that they raised for the sake of building that building. Now, if this were modern times and a shul was going to do a construction project and raised money and ended up not doing that project, what happens to that money, I ask you? It goes into the general fund and it doesn't come out, all right? Well, they were very honest. They were Erlich Eiden. And what happened? If you gave $5 for the building fund, they paid you back. And in fact, they didn't pay you back $5. It was 8 years later, they paid you back $6.68 because of interest. So they violated the Torah prohibition of interest, but they were honest, okay? So why did the society fail? That's the big question. Why did it fail? I mean, after all, we know the rest of the story. We know that in the 19th century, Reform Judaism takes off and becomes to dominate the American Jewish scene. So why was the earliest experiment a failure? Well, a few factors. Number one, their leader left. Number two, they were ahead of their time. Number three, there was no other reform movement in America going on within Judaism. They were an isolated case. Also, they had no rabbis to support them. This is all lay-led. They lacked theological training, so they couldn't justify their changes in the face of the traditionalists. And maybe the thought of returning to the parent congregation was appealing because then they could influence the parent congregation from within and transform the parent congregation into a reform shul, which, by the way, is exactly what ends up happening. Okay, so the fight would continue. The fight continues in 1840. The years between 1824 and 1840 see a dramatic change in the American Jewish community. Whereas in 1820 there were 3,000 Jews, by 1840 there were 15,000 Jews, a fivefold increase. And whereas previously it was all dominated by Spanish Portuguese congregations, now you have all over the place, even German congregations. There are 20 shuls in 1840. So the Germanic element is becoming dominant. Well, in 1836, the position of Chazan in Beit Elohim was vacant, and they needed to hire somebody. So there was a search committee, you know? You call YU and you get the search committee going. Well, the board wanted to hire a traditionalist Chazan, and they were keenly aware that there might be people who were technically qualified in the sense that they could lead the davening, be a bal kore, you know, they were a kolbo, they were like a shabbos, and they knew what they were doing, but who might be tempted to institute reforms. So they were very careful. They wanted to hire someone who was technically competent, but also ideologically safe and not a dangerous gambit. Well, they found someone named Gustavus Poznanski, who had come from Posen, as his name indicates, Kishmo Kenhu, which was a German-Polish region, and he was associated in recent years with Sheriff Israel in New York. Okay? So Isaac Leiser, the leader of traditional Judaism in America at that time, and next week we'll discuss Isaac Leiser's career at length, he vouched for Poznanski as being a safe choice. You know, you could hire this guy, and he's not going to become a Meshumid or a Meshuggah reformer. Okay? So the board was sent a delegation to New York to interview the guy. And they were satisfied with the interview. He got the job, and he performed the job very well. So in 1838, even before his period of probation was over, they offered him a lifetime contract, a life tenure, as the Chazan of Beit Elohim. Very good. Well, problem. In April of 1838, the shul burned down. This happened, you know, in antiquity, and not so antiquity, buildings would burn down. All right, but you have the insurance money, and they rebuild. And by April of 1840, the new building is ready to be dedicated. Well, during this two-year period between the fire and the rebuilding, Poznanski had certain changes of opinion. Whether these were sincere or self-serving with an eye towards professional success, I can't say, since I wasn't there, and I don't want to besmirch the man's reputation any more than it has been, but he decided to be in favor of reforms. What kind of reform? So number one, instrumental music. He wants an organ. Also, many of the old people who had been members of the Reform Society of Israelites a decade earlier were now rejoining Beit Elohim. So you have a chazan, effectively a clergyman, who wants the organ, whose attitude is changing, and you have a membership that's evolving to include or to re-include people with reformist tendencies. So on July 14th, 1840, 38 members of the shul petitioned the board for installing an organ in the synagogue for religious services. They mention that there's precedent for the organ. Does anybody know where that precedent comes from? Anybody know? Okay, so let's assume for the moment that they're not referring to the Beis HaMikdash, that yes, we know there was musical instruments in Beis HaMikdash, just as there was vocal music, there was instrumental music, Shira Bapeh, Shira Bakli. Okay, fine. But after the temple was destroyed, you know, the synagogue is another type of institution altogether. Where is there a synagogue precedent for an organ?
Germany?
Not Germany, but close.
Austria.
Prague.
Oh,
in Prague, in the 1700s, there was an organ. In the traditional synagogue, there was no non-traditional synagogue in Prague at the time. But the difference is they stopped playing the music on Friday night after Lechadodi, before Mizmor Shir Yom HaShabbos. Now, technically speaking, when does Shabbos begin? When you accept it, which is before the candle lighting hour. And Mizmor Shir Yom HaShabbos was the point which they would stop playing the organ. Was the organ played by a Jew or a Gentile? It was played by a Jew. It was played by a Jew, but not on Shabbos. It was in advance of Shabbos. That's the halachic legitimacy of it. Okay, but where else was there a precedent for an organ? The answer is in the early Reform synagogues of Europe, notably in Hamburg and in France, in Napoleon.
It's Germany.
Okay, so they say it's kosher. We should do this, and we're willing to pay for it. Meaning not out of shul funds, but a private donation of the organ. Well, the board voted by a vote of 4-1 against the petition on the grounds that it violated Article 1 of the Constitution calling for Minhag Sfarad, and Minhag Sfarad does not allow an organ. Okay, so again, this is a religious reform, but they view it as a constitutional change. They agreed, however, unlike in 1824, the board shut things down completely and that was the end of it. In 1840, the board doesn't shut it down. It votes against the proposal, but agrees to call a congregational meeting at which these matters will be discussed further. Well, that opens up a can of worms. When you call a congregational meeting, you never know what's going to happen. People are easily swayed. They're fickle. So, the meeting is called for Sunday morning, July 26 at 9 o'clock. Shacharis was at 8, the meeting is at 9. Everybody shows up at 9. Okay. So, 90 people came to the meeting. By a vote of 56-31, they allowed Poznanski to enter and address his views on the organ, meaning it's at a congregational meeting, the rabbi usually isn't there. You know, he's an employee, not a member. So the Poznanski is a chazan, he's an employee, not a member. But they invited him to come in to give his learned opinion, if you want to call it a learned opinion, on the subject. So he came in and he cited a few religious texts in favor of the organ. The board, the minutes of the meeting, which have been preserved for the last 180 years, don't mention which particular religious texts he quoted. I'd be curious to know what those were. Probably not, you know, a Tosfos and Gittin. He didn't know that stuff. At best, he was quoting a pasuk in the Bible somewhere from the Tanakh. Mm-hmm. But he quoted something and was compelling enough that a lot of people went along with him. Okay, so a former member of the Reform Society called for the building of an organ through voluntary contributions, not from regular synagogue funds. There was an objection, but the chair allowed the motion. It passed by a vote of 46 to 40. So bingo, there's going to be an organ. The truth of the matter is, the organ had been a controversial topic in Europe before it was a controversial topic in the United States. Mm-hmm. The Temple controversy erupted in 1818, 1819. So the Hamburg folks, they solicited opinions from all the rabbis in Europe they could find who might give them a lenient ruling. Well, they could only find Aaron Koren in Hungary, in Arad, in the far corner of Hungary, and two Indian rabbis, including Chaim Yosef Recanati. The vast majority of European rabbis said, no, you can't have an organ. It's totally treif. And charged against the organ. So the Chassam Sofer and his disciples were the ones who fought back with Eila Divrei HaBris. And we, in past years, we read from Eila Divrei HaBris at length. And we also read from the Reform tract, a treatise, Noga HaTzedek, and Or Noga, written by Eliezer Lieberman. So this is not new to some of the crowd listening tonight, but you know, this was a major controversy with learned people discussing it. In America, these are not learned people. These are Amaratsim, basically, but they're relying upon certain precedent that might have existed in Europe. Okay, so the arguments against the organ are, it's goyish, number one. Music is forbidden after the Churban, after the destruction of the temple. It's transgressive of the Sabbath. And it comes to dominate and people don't actually pray. How do you like that one? That's an interesting point, and it's true. You go to a service with an organ, and what happens to the people actually davening? They stop. They just, it's a show, it's a concert. Okay, now what are some of the arguments in favor of the organ? One, the service is really boring and we need to spruce it up. Number two, it isn't goyish, it's universal. It could be just as Jewish as it is goyish. It's just music sounds good. We like music for prayer. And lastly, it facilitates kavana. Now, kavana here doesn't mean kavana in the traditional sense of I think about the words mechalkel chayim bechesed, mechayim esim brach. No, it doesn't mean that at all. It means spiritual elevation by dint of the music. So you might not actually be mouthing any words at all. It may not be davening in the traditional sense, but it's kavana in the spiritual sense of kavana. Okay, fine. So the traditionalists argued that this was a constitutional change, again, and that according to the bylaws of 1836, you need a three-quarters vote. So it used to be you needed two-thirds. Now you need three-quarters vote to approve of something. They threatened to take the matter to the law of the courts of the law of the land, meaning we'll go to the Arkot Shel Akum. Now, going to Gentile courts, is that considered a no-no in Judaism? Big no-no. If you read the Gemara of Odezara and elsewhere, going to the Gentile courts is considered a shanda. You got to go to the Beis Din. Well, there is no Beis Din. This is America, 1840. So, in any event, they're threatening that if you do this, which we think is not is illegitimate by the bylaws of the congregation, we'll take you to court. Well, Isaac Leiser advised the president of the shul, Nathan Hart, who was a traditionalist, to take out an injunction against the majority, but Nathan Hart chose not to do so. Then what happened was Hart and his colleague Moses Hertz, who was also a traditionalist, they died shortly thereafter. So here the leaders of the traditional faction of the shul just dropped dead all of a sudden. I mean, they were older, but they dropped dead. So the remaining traditionalists thought that an appeal to the courts would have been repugnant to their deceased leaders. And they decided, you know what, we're not going to do it. We're not going to drag the Jews through the mud in the South Carolina Court of Appeals. Instead, we'll retire from the shul. We'll resign our membership and we'll start another shul, an Orthodox Spanish-Portuguese type shul. Okay, so good. What do? They establish Sheirith Israel a few blocks away. Now, Sheirith Israel means what? The remnant of Israel. So what are they? They are the remnant of traditional Israel. If everybody else is favoring radical reform and going to assimilate, we are the last remnant who are going to keep religion strong, okay? And it's also the name of the shul in New York, so which is still an Orthodox shul at that time and even today. So the reformers consolidated their control over the board of the parent congregation by increasing the size of the board from 5 members to 7 members. So like Franklin Roosevelt tried to stack the Supreme Court. So they stacked the board with more members and more reformist members. So now the traditionalists, although there were some still in the shul and some still on the board, they can't regain control. And they changed the bylaws in a little bit of a nasty way. Listen to this one. They changed the bylaws to give the board absolute control over religious matters, and they that you can't be buried in the shul cemetery unless chazan, the chazan of the shul officiates. Now, Poznansky is seen as a reformer. So if you're a traditional Jew and you resign from the shul, do you want to have a treif rabbi officiating at your mother or father's funeral? No, you would never want that. So all of a sudden, you're out. You can't use the burial grounds of your ancestors. And worse, they imposed a $100, a tremendous amount of money. $100 in 1840 is a tremendous amount of money. $100 penalty for any member of Beit Elohim who attends services locally in another shul. Meaning, if you try to remain as a member, but you also go to the other place, we're gonna charge you an extra $100. Now, what's the goal here? The goal here is to prevent people from being nominally still members of Beit Elohim just for cemetery purposes, when really they're members of the other shul. With the penalty, you'll have to make a choice. I'm either here or I'm there. You can't dance at two chasnas at once. Okay. So, on February 21st, 1841, Beit Elohim accepts the organ from the private funding group, and it was given on condition that it be continually used for synagogue services. But if at any point in time the synagogue were to decide to go back to traditionalism and not use an organ, the organ would have to be given back to the funders of the organ. Okay, it was on loan that it should be used. So there was bad blood in the remaining among the remaining members of Beit Elohim, because not everybody was a radical reformer. Some didn't break away with Sherith Israel, but they were still, you know, fairly traditional in character. So this bad blood led to a really nasty episode. People accused Poznansky of being a mamzer, literally being a mamzer. Not euphemistically a mamzer, but literally a mamzer. And so the kahila had to, the shul had to send a letter to the kahila in Posen, in Poland, where Poznansky's father was born, and where Poznansky himself was born, and where the father still lived. And the kahila wrote back that Joseph Poznansky, married to Sarah Poznansky, are pious members of the community, and they had legitimate children, including Chaim Yankel, Beryl, and Shmerel, and Gustavo. Okay, so he's not a mamzer. He's a legitimate child of Joseph and Sarah Poznansky. Now, this is crazy. Mm-hmm. A letter from 5,000 miles away that so-and-so is not a bastard child? I mean, okay. But that's what happens when things get dirty in shul politics. So, also...
It's like a birther.
A little bit, yes. So, the reformers started to take things a little too far, and they revised the Maimonidean Creed. The moderate reformers, who had made their peace with the organ, were alarmed and called for a congregational meeting. Meaning, okay, you want your organ, we can have your organ. But don't push your luck. Don't go too far in the direction of reform. Well, they're going too far. So peace was arranged at this meeting in July of 41. And it was agreed to freeze the reforms as they are at the present time. Let me ask you a question. Does the act of freezing the reforms as they are at any given moment typically work?
I don't think so.
The answer is no, it doesn't work. Why? Because when there is momentum in a certain direction, it's hard to just halt that momentum. People instinctively want to go further with their agenda. That's why it's called the reform movement, the conservative movement. You're moving in a certain direction. You don't know where you're headed yet, but you're not going to stop here. You're going to keep going. Okay. So it was agreed that any further changes, including the removal of the organ, would require a 3/4 vote. So now the organ has been established as tradition. You can't get rid of it without a 3/4 vote. But on August 2nd, 1841, the board of the shul had to deal with another issue. There was a call from Isaac Leiser in Philadelphia, who was the chazan of Mikveh Israel. The American Jewish communities, all the synagogues, to establish a union of synagogues, like the OU, or the United Synagogue of America, or the Union of American Hebrew Congregations. You know, all the denominations have their union of synagogues. Well, there wasn't any of that yet, but Leiser says, you know, we should have a union of synagogues. Well, Beit Elohim's leadership says, you know what, Leiser is a traditionalist, and we're afraid if there is a union, then there's going to be an ecclesiastical hierarchy that is going to try to impose its will upon us, and it will stymie any further efforts at reform. So guess what? We're rejecting the call for Jewish congregational unity because we want our autonomy. Was that a good thing or a bad thing? I mean, in the end, it probably was a bad thing because Jewish unity is a good thing. All right, but they had their reasons why they didn't want to be subservient to somebody else's religious dictates. Okay.
Isn't this contradiction very inherent in the type of society that you live in? In an autocratic society, there is a tendency for hierarchy to be established, including a kind of Jewish hierarchy.
Correct.
But in a democratic, basically decentralized society as we have with states, etc., this is impossible to enforce uniformity.
You're right, which is why until you have the crystallizing of religious denominations along theological / sociological lines, which you do in the 20th century, until you get to that point, there's going to be a real hesitation about forming any kind of union, because everybody likes their independence, their freedom. They don't want to have an un-American system of an ecclesiastical hierarchy. It's only when you no longer fear that, because you basically know where everybody's position is on the religious issues, that then in the 20th century you could have the OU, the UAHC, and the U.S. United Synagogue of America. Okay, so despite not wanting to join together with other traditional congregations around America, they do want to join with Sheareth Israel in Charleston. For what purpose? Well, we need a show. Everybody's hungry. You want steak for dinner. And for those of us that don't eat treif, we want kosher, you need a shochet. Well, why should you have one shochet for this shul and one shochet for that shul? You can hire one shochet for the community. So even though these shuls are at loggerheads and so many issues, we can join together for a shochet. Okay, fine. Now, despite the promise to freeze any further reforms, there was an attempt in 1842 to abolish a certain custom. You'll never guess what this one was. It has to do with one of the Yom Tovim. Anyone want to take a stab at it? Take a guess.
2 days, Yontif?
We'll get to that in a second. Something less dramatic than 2 days, Yontif.
Arava?
No. Tikkun Leil Shavuos. They wanted to abolish Tikkun Leil Shavuos. In the the tikkun is a big deal. By the Ashkenazim, we learn all night. The rabbis give shiurim, and we learn daf yomi, and all sorts of learning. But by the Sephardic rite, the actual tikkun is a real important liturgy, where you do the beginning and end of every book of the Bible, of every book of the Mishnah, and so on and so forth. So they did in Beit Elohim the tikkun every year. And what happened? The reform-minded and Poznansky wanted to get rid of it. Well, you're rocking the boat. Then, in April of 1843, on Pesach, Poznansky gives a sermon in which he announces that he favors abolishing the second day of Yom Tov. The board took Poznansky to task for this, inquired whether he had any intention of sermonizing about controversial topics in the future, because they want to know about it in advance, and they want to know they want to let him know their opinion about whatever various changes he has in mind, because they don't want him to be an independent operator. Mm-hmm. Okay, so he gets offended by the fact that he doesn't have freedom of the pulpit anymore. You know, who famously creates the free synagogue? Stephen Wise, the Stephen Wise free synagogue. It's not that there are no dues. Oh, you'll pay a due. But the pulpit is free. You could say whatever you want. So he could talk about Jesus once, and he did. And that's what almost got him into big trouble.
So the
free pulpit is a major issue among the reformers, because they're... Rabbi will often have the desire to say something that the congregation, the laity, is not yet ready to hear. Okay, so Poznansky is told, maybe you want to reconsider your comments. He does, but his response was just as chutzpahdik as his initial comment. He's nasty to the board and says, I want my freedom, don't boss me around. Okay. So he says, because I'm dissatisfied with you, the board, I am now going to no longer sermonize at all. Forget on controversial topics. I am not giving a speech every Shabbos. And I am no longer going to give the prayers in English. I am only going to give the prayers in Hebrew, which was my job when you hired me. Meaning, I'll become an old-fashioned chazan. just daven in Hebrew and that's it. Of course, the people are not happy about that. They wanted a more modern minister / preacher type chazan, not an old style chazan, just for the Hebrew. Okay, so the board voted 4-2 to ask him to apologize, and he didn't really apologize. Blah 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 blah. Okay, the synagogue has a congregational meeting, knowing that Poznanski's on the hot seat, and by a vote of 24-27, so it failed by a vote of 24-27. To return to full tradition, all Mosaic and rabbinical laws was defeated. Now that's a pretty close vote. Two votes in the other direction, it would have been 26-25, and you would have had an Orthodox shul again. So it goes to show Beit Elohim, despite the fact that the traditionalists broke away and that Beit Elohim has an organ, it's still a divided shul between people who want tradition and people who like aggressive reform. Okay. So in April 1843, a conspiracy was hatched. Something was afoot.
Mm-hmm.
The traditionalists of Beit Elohim and the breakaway shul of Sherith Israel got together to conspire to retake the reins of Beit Elohim by having all the Sherith Israel people rejoin the shul. And a bylaw meeting where they would change the bylaws to favor the traditional camp. One of the conditions of this deal happening was that a mikveh had to be built. The Sherith Israel crowd really was more frum than the Beit Elohim crowd, and there was... Mm-hmm. They wanted a mikveh built. Okay. Also, one of the conditions was that we hire no chazan. Why do we hire no chazan? Because a chazan could result in the same problem that Poznanski created. You never you hire a rabbi that he's going to go treif all of a sudden. You know, you hire a rabbi with smicha from the greatest yeshivas and rosh yeshivas in the world, and all of a sudden he's eating pork. It happened in the 19th century. So we don't trust the clergy, therefore, no clergy. Pretty good idea. Then they say, you can't daven for the Amud if anybody ever heard about you that you favored a religious reform. So there's a litmus test, a kashrus test to daven for the Amud. In American synagogues today, your typical modern Orthodox synagogue, is there a litmus test to davening for the Amud? Maybe. Maybe you have to be Shomer Shabbos. Maybe, I don't know what. Maybe you can't be intermarried. There probably are some shuls that have some kind of standards where if you're transgressive of those standards, you can't daven. But this was the idea, that if we heard you were in favor of any reform, you can't daven. Okay, fine. Well, they also ruled that you could do a funeral without the chazan. Why? Because nobody wants Poznanski. So this circumvents using the guy that nobody likes. On May 15th, 1843, they held this meeting, and the traditionalists, to an extent, took over the shul. However, there were claims that this was in violation of the bylaws, and it was by hook or by crook, and that the reform camp really should have been in control because they controlled the board. So the matter went to the civil courts, the Court of Common Pleas of South Carolina, and the factions were at loggerheads for 2.5-3 years, between 1844 and 1847. The courts, for that matter, to their great credit, did not want to get involved in theological disputes. Now, there's a good reason for this. We have separation of church and state in America, and the courts are not supposed to adjudicate theological issues. They're only supposed to adjudicate issues relating to the governance of nonprofit institutions. You know, was a coup done correctly within the laws of the land and within the laws of the congregation? So they could address the legitimacy of the whether voting members had actually resigned from the shul, the legitimacy of board elections, of congregational meetings, that sort of thing. The reformers won the battle in the end. The traditionalists had no choice but to jump ship and restart Sherith Israel. So in truth, even the reform-minded Beit Elohim crowd was not united after their victory. They remained divided on issues of liturgy. In 1847, in January, Poznanski offered to resign on the premise that a new religious leader could bring harmony to the shul. In other words, you have a divisive clergyman, who half the shul hates. Well, he knows half the shul hates him. So what is for Shalom al Yisrael? I'll resign, you'll hire somebody else, and everything will be happy. Okay, cool. The leadership rejected his offer of resignation. Rejected it. Why? I reject it because They felt that it would be injurious to the cause of religious reform if their leader Poznanski were to step aside. So instead, they made Poznanski the chairman of the committee that would search for his own successor. This happens sometimes when a rabbi is ready to retire. They'll allow the rabbi to play a role in the search committee to find his successor. Okay, so that's what they did here. But there really wasn't a serious search for a successor. In 1850, something curious happened. Isaac Meir Wise, who we're going to talk about at length next week and the week after that, okay, the most important rabbi in 19th century America, he was horrible, but he was the most important. So Isaac Meir Wise showed up for a debate between Poznanski and Morris Raphael, who was a traditionalist. And while he was there, they offered to hire him as the rabbi, because Isaac Meir Wise was a rabbi, or so he claimed to be a rabbi. I am fairly convinced that he was not, that he was a charlatan. He was never ordained, never got smicha. But that's Hoffman's opinion. I can't prove it, but it's in the literature, it's in the historiography, that we don't know whether he was a real rabbi. He passed himself off as one, but I suspect not. All right, but they offered him to make him the rabbi, as opposed to Poznanski, who was just a chazan without any ordination. They offered him the job. He took the job, but he really didn't take the job, because a few days later, he left to go back to Albany, where he was the rabbi there. And he never came back to South Carolina. So Beit Elohim could have had Isaac Meir Wise, but he chose to not really take the job. Okay. Now, during the Civil War, we have a few minutes left. I just want to discuss what happened to the shul. During the Civil War, both Beit Elohim and Sherith Israel had their buildings severely damaged by Union shelling from the north. The Northern Army was shelling the city of Charleston, and a lot of buildings got hit, including the two shuls. But as it turned out, Sherith Israel's damage to the structure was worse than Beit Elohim. So it comes High Holiday time, 1865. The Sherith Israel crowd asks for permission from Beit Elohim to use their building to conduct their services. So now we see there's maybe a rapprochement, that maybe they can get back together. If not in general, at least for the High Holidays. But as it turned out, in 1866, the shuls merged altogether. They became one synagogue again. Beit Elohim. And Sherith Israel's name disappeared, but all the Torahs and stuff came to Beit Elohim. So how did this happen? How could it be that after 40 years of fighting and 3 years in court battles and shuls going on different paths, they could become one again? A few factors. One, time heals old wounds. You know, a lot of people who were originally involved were dead, and it was long forgotten what the fight was about. Secondly, some reform element crept into Sherith Israel. Bear in mind, America in the mid-19th century is not Borough Park, the 20th or 21st century. There's not a lot of Yiddishkeit in America. So even among traditionalists, as time goes on, they become less traditional. They become more Americanized, and they're not so interested in preserving the old rites. Thirdly, a Minhag Ashkenaz shul was established in Charleston in 1855 called Brit Shalom, which had a Germanic and Polish orientation. So because there was a frum immigrant Eastern European-style congregation, there no longer was a need for a Spanish-Portuguese Orthodox synagogue. The two Spanish-Portuguese synagogues, one Reform, one traditional, could once again join together, because if you really were a religious Jew, you could go to Brit Shalom. And lastly, the organ stayed, but they agreed no more changes. Again, the business with no more changes. If we could freeze the Reform as is now, then we could placate those who could maybe make their peace with it. So it wasn't an easy merger, but it happened. So that is the story of the Charleston Experiment of Reform, 1824 through about 1847, and followed by what happened to them in the Civil War. Now, next week, I want to discuss Isaac Leiser, who was the leader of the traditional camp within American Jewish life in the 1830s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. And I want to discuss his career to contrast that with the rabbis, the Reform rabbis who come to America in the 1840s, 50s, and 60s, who want to take American Judaism in a very different direction than Leiser, and to see to what extent it is possible to have a united community, and to what extent theological differences or differences in terms of ritual practice make it inevitable that you'll have a dramatic fissure between the two schools of thought. And we're going to lead American Jewry on the path of denominationalism. Any questions? Questions? No questions? Well, on that note, everybody, have a good night. I'll see you next.
Let's talk.
Take care, everybody.